Hello, this is Jamie Robinson. I'm a professor of economics and economics of healthcare at the University of California, Berkeley, and I participate in a number of the TPG summits that happen around different countries in the world, and was privileged to be part of the summit we did in London in October. And as part of that, I got to know Dr. David Oliver, who is a prominent consultant in English and American language, that means specialist in the National Health Service, as well as very visible on the policy world. And so we're very lucky to have him do this podcast with us today. And David, may I ask you first just to introduce yourself, both in terms of your clinical activity and your, let's call it, policy or professional activity outside that.
Sure. Thanks, James. It's good to be here. Good to be invited. So I'm David Oliver. I've been a doctor in the National Health Service for 35 years now. For the past 26, I've been a consultant, as you say, that's a specialist, in my case, in geriatric medicine and the acute end of general internal medicine. I work in the southeast of England, but alongside my day job, my clinical day job, I've had a variety of other roles, including being the president of the British Geriatric Society and the vice president of the Royal College of Physicians of London, which hosts about 35 different internal medicine specialties. And I spent several years in the Department of Health alongside my clinical work as the National Director for Older People's Services. I also have a research career largely around patient safety services for older people. And I've worked for the King's Fund and Nuffield Trust Health Policy think tanks. And for about the past 8 or 9 years, I've been a regular weekly columnist for the British Medical Journal and writing a few other outlets as well. But I'd say I'm a failed academic these days. I've not been academically active for a few years because I got sucked into the kind of policy and policy commentary and professional leadership world. But first and foremost, I'm still chugging along delivering clinical care to patients alongside whatever else I do.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you definitely a triple threat, as we call it, in terms of the range of your activities. From the American perspective, England is the English health system is very remarkable because on the one hand, it's a universal system with very little out-of-pocket cost sharing from the patients. And it also, but it delivers care at a cost per patient population, significantly lower than in the US. And so there's always been this sort of fascination, how do you do it? And so there's appreciation, fascination, whatever you want to call that. And then recently, though, we also hear about also the stresses of the system in terms of the capacity, partly due to COVID, but partly due to other things. So maybe we could just start by, if you would, for the American audience, talk a little bit about what you see as the strengths of the NHS as a health system, and then some of the challenges it faces today.
Okay, well, yeah, we'll start with talking about strength. I think it's not just my view, it's what we see on various international comparisons of health systems. The National Health Service is universal. It's free at the point of use with no upfront cash payments or co-payments. It's essentially funded through general taxation, and access to care is based on the need and not ability to pay. And they were the founding principles of the National Health Service right from seeing its first patient in 1948. And so we are less likely than any system really to have people either bankrupted by the cost of care or avoiding seeking help because of the cost of care, and having significant upfront payments. And from that perspective, it's a real strength of the system. And as you say, if you look at per capita spend or percentage of GDP, we're kind of, for OECD nations, we're kind of middling. You can argue which metric you use. So we're good on equity of access, and we're good at comprehensiveness and universality of service. Recently, because of access problems, more people have started to pay out of pocket to try and jump queues and bypass the system. But a relatively low percentage of our care is delivered within the private sector or using private health insurance. The other thing about having a genuinely national system is we can have national pay scales, national workforce planning. We can have national performance incentives for the whole system, and key performance indicators, and national clinical audits to look, to describe quality of care. And you may regard this as a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but in terms of medical careers, because we have national pay scales, there are not massive pay differentials between different specialties that you might see in North America, where you have people, secondary care interventionists earning multiples of what primary care generalists can. And traditionally, a strength has been primary care, general practice, family medicine, call it what you will, that although general practice only gets about 9% of the NHS budget, they do see the majority of the contacts in the NHS, and everybody is registered with a general practitioner, or I guess you might say primary care physician, family physician in the US. And that's always been the bedrock of our system. And again, you may regard this as a strength or a weakness, but the access to secondary and tertiary care services has traditionally been via the GP. So you can't, there's no culture of doctor shopping unless you've got your own money. We've got comprehensiveness, we've got universality, we've got equity, low use of out-of-pocket payments, and the ability for kind of central planning and central performance directives and incentives, which is all good. But if you want me to go on and talk about weaknesses, I will, or have you got any follow-on questions from what I just said there?
No, I think that that's a really good overview of the strengths and the historical strength. And I guess one question from the American perspective is it possible, particularly on the budget management, to go too far? Has there been underinvestment in the system? Obviously, all the whole world got whacked by COVID unexpectedly, but and the stress on the workforce, the physician, nurses, other workforce. Of course, we see that in the United States as well. We've had strikes and other activities here, but certainly hear about them in England as well.
I mean, it certainly is possible to go too far, because we have politically accountable budgetary decisions made, and obviously competing demands for the use of taxpayers' money, then funding does have an impact on service delivery. If you go, I'm slightly off the point of your question, but I do think it's relevant that if you look over the history of the National Health Service, it's received an average annual real terms funding increase of about 3.4% per annum. But during the Blair Brown government between 1997 and 2010, the economy was in good shape, and it received about 6% annual real terms funding uplift throughout that decade or so. What happened after the 2010 election, and we'd all faced the global banking crash, the financial repercussions of that. The funding increase went to about 1.4% in real terms for 7 or 8 years. And of course, that has an impact. It has an impact on staff wages, which have fallen very significantly in real terms over the past 10 to 15 years. It has an impact on capital expenditure. And we know on international comparisons, we spend far less than most industrialized nations on facilities, diagnostic equipment, IT, and so forth. And it's also impacted on, investment in public health and prevention policy. And these things do start to take their toll. And the other thing which we haven't touched on is that in the UK, there is a division between healthcare, which is free at the point of delivery and needs-based, and social care, which might be things like nursing or residential facilities or home-based personal care. And those things are the responsibility of local government, and they are means tested and quite heavily rationed and do require upfront payment and have market provision. And when social care suffers significant funding gaps, which it has done, and recruitment gaps, it impacts on the National Health Service because you can't get people out of hospital. They get stuck in beds. You can't keep people in their own homes when there's social support issues. And if your listeners are interested, there's a couple of good reports I would steer them towards. One is by the Institute for Government, which is a politically neutral think tank. And it's called The NHS Crisis: Does the Government Have a Plan? And there's another one by Chris Ham, a very well-known health services academic, about the NHS from 2000 to 2020. And what they showed was that during that period of plenty, performance across a whole range of indicators improved. You know, and we have national indicators. So things like how long you wait in the emergency department, how long you wait to see a specialist, how long you wait to have your procedure, annual patient satisfaction or staff satisfaction surveys, population level outcomes, healthy life expectancy. These all improved very steadily during that time of plenty. And by 2010, the service was in good shape. But following the 2010 election, and then we had this disinvestment, everything's gone backwards. So I'll give you a few for instances. One is we had virtually abolished waits and long waits. We had a national standard that 95% of people should be seen within 4 hours attending the emergency room and either during that 4 hours discharged or admitted. And we were hitting that target for 95% of people in 2010, and now we're not hitting it at all. We had a standard that you should be seen within 2 weeks for an urgent referral or 3 months for a non-urgent referral. But we got rid of all those long waiters. We now have 7.5 million people on waiting lists for elective planned care. And that, of course, means that people could be dying while they're on the waiting list, and they could be dying because of overcrowding in the emergency room. And we've started now to see growing health inequalities at a population level and reductions in life expectancy and healthy life expectancy. And crucially, because we have annual public surveys and annual staff surveys, both the satisfaction of the general public and the satisfaction and well-being of the staff have plummeted in that time period. And so we now have record low levels of satisfaction since about 1997. And if you ask the British public what they're unhappy about, it's access. It's taking too long to see my GP. I can't get an appointment. It's taking too long to have my elective procedure. If you come to the emergency department, it's overcrowded. And they recognize that a lot of that is because of staffing. The public still have a high level of trust in the NHS as an institution, high levels of trust in clinicians. But meanwhile, the staff morale issue is really important because there's no service without a workforce. And what's happened and accelerated by 3 years of COVID pandemic medicine is we have growing workforce gaps at the moment. For instance, 1 in 9 nursing vacancies is unfilled. And we've been quite heavily reliant on international recruitment, often from poorer nations. And we can't so much rely on that anymore because the big picture politics is a bit like in the USA. They want to say that they're clamping down on immigration. And there's the issue of, is it ethical to go and take staff from, you know, poorer countries? So we've got this major issue now with real terms pay eroded for staff, with morale eroded, accelerated by the COVID pandemic, and people are leaving. And so there's been very big pressure to produce a long-term workforce plan for the NHS, which was published last year. But has received some criticism. And the final thing I'll just say is that at the moment, I've mentioned the social care crisis, which is very acute, and declining public health because of austerity. But it's very rare for healthcare professionals in the UK to go on strike. I mean, during my lifetime, the doctors have only been on strike one previous time, and the nurses have never been on strike. But we now have a series of industrial relations disputes over terms and conditions, and the government are saying they can't afford bigger settlements. And that's still dragging on, that whole business.
Yes. In some sense, as you describe the evolution of the performance, it was good when the funding was good, and it has deteriorated when the funding has deteriorated. One would conclude that the solution is to throw more money at the problem. And yet the government is, of course, saying that it doesn't have the money. And so if you had the ear of the decision makers, what would you suggest in the next couple of years and then a little bit going forward in terms of resolving this access problem and the popular support for the NHS?
Well, I think if they're serious, and of course, I haven't mentioned to your listeners that across the United Kingdom, each of the four nations of England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland have their own government and their own health systems, but they all face the same wicked problems, more or less. The answer is that they need to spend more money, because if they don't, we're going to continue to have crumbling facilities, inadequate capacity and services outside hospital, problems with workforce retention. I'll just give you one example. I've told you about the strength of general practice primary care, but we actually have about 3,000 fewer GPs now than we had a decade ago. And our GPs in international studies are seeing twice as many patients as their counterparts in other developed nations. And, I mean, to put it in context, they'd be routinely seeing 50 or 60 patient contacts a day, which
Wow.
if I tell that to people from other countries, they're a bit horrified by that. And you can tinker around the margins with, workforce well-being initiatives and, flexible rotoring and support for childcare and all that. But fundamentally, unless we invest in the workforce, which is the biggest source of spend, and capital expenditure and facilities, things will get worse. We do need to invest, as you do in the States, in prevention and health inequalities and wider socioeconomic determinants of health, so that we keep people well for longer. And that's not all in the gift of health service. Now, the Institute for Fiscal Studies this very week produced a report, because it's election year, suggesting that the government, well, all parties need to be more honest, that we have, by European standards, a low to middling tax take overall, and there are some really difficult trade-offs. But the interesting thing is, the public, when surveyed, have no appetite for switching towards an insurance-based, multiple payer, multiple provider model. What they want is for the NHS model to work like it was doing in 2010. And I think what's gone on is that, because performance has got worse because of reduced investment, there are some people now on the small state pro-market right who are saying the only way to solve the problem is to move towards an insurance-based model. And yet, what they're not mentioning, the lobbyists, is that a number of countries like Italy, Spain, Portugal, Sweden, New Zealand have perfectly decent health systems that are basically tax funded and publicly provided. So, and the conclusions I've read from health policy analysts is that it's not about whether you have an insurance-based model or a tax-funded model. It's really about an adequately staffed, adequately invested model. But I think fundamentally, either we need to be honest with the public about the need to increase payment, or we're going to have to move towards a two-tier system where we say, well, there are core services that the public sector provides, and there are other services that are going to have to be means tested. But no political party has gone and made the case for the public to move towards co-payments or insurance-based models or anything at the moment. It's tough. Somebody said, I think Michael Heseltine, that the NHS was the closest thing the English had to a religion. And talking about payment for healthcare in the UK would be as unpopular as gun control in the US. It'd be political suicide. So I think there's a bit of denial at the moment about that, but we have to have an honest conversation about it.
Yeah, well, it's those of us that are in the policy world, we tend to make proposals for policy change and structural change. But I see certainly in the United States, and I assume with you as well, an exhaustion of we don't want any more reorganizations, we don't want any more reforms. Keep it simple. And because the amount of energy that goes into that, and the results are always less than one hopes.
Exactly. And in fact, there's a great analysis by the Nuffield Trust called Doomed to Repeat, which just sets out all the endless structural reorganizations that have gone on in the NHS, that they're driven by the electoral cycle. We have poor institutional memory, and we keep doing things that have already been shown not to work previously. So I agree with you. What people in the service would want is stop messing around with the structure, resource the service properly, invest more in prevention and care outside hospital, so we don't have as much care being driven into buildings, let the professionals run the services. I mean, I do think, and I think this because I've got an American wife and American in-laws, so I've had experience of this, family members using the service over there too. It's easier in the NHS to be able to say, we're not going to do this test, we're not going to give you this treatment, because there's not much evidence of benefit. we don't have perverse incentives to go and investigate or treat people, because our pay is not payment by activity. I'm a public sector salaried employee, and I get exactly the same money, whatever I, you know, whatever I do. So it's good on the one hand that we're not perversely incentivized to over-treat or over-investigate. But the flip side is you do always have capacity and cost constraints at the back of your mind when you're making decisions. And I don't get the impression culturally you could transplant our model to the States. Although being a geriatrician and knowing that geriatrics in the US is a bit of a Cinderella, lower status specialty, when I go to the conferences for American geriatricians, they love the idea of having socialized medicine and public funding, because they think it'd be better for their patients and their specialty. But
yes, well, I believe that the greatest asset of a health system, if it's there, is the social trust on the part of the population. Because if you lose that, like in the United States, I believe trust in the system is low. People, then they're not willing, like just like you experienced, that if the doctor or the insurer or whatever says I don't need this test, well, why do they say that? Is it, do I trust them? Is it for my benefit or their benefit, or is it just? To me, my fear for the British system, English system, is that because of this period of disinvestment and all the problems that it caused, if that erodes that sense of national pride and national commitment, then that's a very important thing, but it's intangible. It's hard to measure, but it's real.
Yeah, at the moment, we have this thing, the annual veracity index about trust in professions, and nurses and doctors consistently top the veracity index. And obviously, politicians are right near the bottom. And we also, on our British Social Attitudes Survey, which is an annual thing, people will still say that the NHS is the institution that makes them most proud to be British. And people will still say on polling they want the current model. On the other hand, like I mentioned, the levels of satisfaction are now pretty poor. And there will be a lot of lobbyists and politicians saying it's time we rip the whole thing up. It's a socialized medicine behemoth, you know, that stemmed out of the post-war settlement of the welfare state, and it's not fit on purpose. We need the agility of an insurance-based service that's more flexible to demand. You know, now, those debates are going on, but I don't think anyone's committing to having the debate at the moment. Whereas they have happened about social care funding, because it's already means tested. Do you have to sell your home to pay for your care, and do you have to use your inheritance that you might give to your children otherwise? We haven't touched on COVID, and I think that's important, because COVID exposed some of the structural weaknesses that those of us in the system knew were there already. If you look at what happened to elective care, most developed nations had to cancel lots of surgery and procedure and outpatient activity in peak COVID, but they've recovered much more quickly because they had more headroom. Whereas because we're running absolutely full capacity all the time, we've never really caught up with that, you know. And COVID also exposed the lack of headroom, the lack of flexibility in our bed base. You know, 2.4 beds per 1,000 people is very low by international standards. Intensive care, we've got 6.7 intensive care beds per 100,000 people. In the US, I think it's about 30, you know, in Germany, it's about 30. So it just kind of exposed the fact that we don't have that much system headroom or resilience. And it's also impacted on the staff as well, because many, many, many clinical staff caught COVID or got burnt out by doing COVID medicine. And, you know, so it's shone a light on some.
Yes.
Some problems that were there already.
There's a dilemma for any system on how much to pay for excess capacity in the good times.
Yeah.
So they're in the bad times. And there's presumably no precise good answer to that. I've got one more question on somewhat topic. The British government, the English government, is very keen on supporting the life sciences industry as a part of the British economy, as a source of jobs, exports,
yep.
and lot of concern about competition from China, competition from the United States, et cetera. And so they've got various programs to invest and support the research universities and all that goes yep. with that. And in principle, the NHS as a publicly spirited part of the system could be an asset to that, sort of aligned with that.
Yep.
But as we've just been talking about, the NHS is very stressed, the workforce, the facilities. So even delivering today's medicines to today's patients, how can you think about tomorrow's medicines as they come through the pipeline, or role of clinical trials in the hospitals? How do you, as a practicing doctor and who deals a lot with the rank and file physicians out there, how does the workforce think about, to the extent they think about it at all, this life sciences policy activity that's going on in certain parts of the government?
I think, yeah, I mean, just like in the USA, we have teaching hospitals with medical schools and other academic, you know, but science departments right next door. And obviously in those big institutions, there are plenty of clinical academics and related university departments, and they will have a culture of doing research as part of the clinical offering. But there are other research trials that will recruit patients and have local research leads just in district general hospitals around the country. And hospitals will have specific teams to oversee that. I think that, if I'm honest, your average jobbing clinician isn't very touched by that kind of work unless they've got a specific research remit, although they may be involved, as I say, in recruiting trial patients. And just like in the States, there's a growing increase in kind of pragmatic local quality improvement. But I think the issue of Brexit, it was warned at the time, would mess up European research collaborations and drug and technology improvements. What we do have is the National Institute for Health Research, which prioritizes all the biomedical and clinical research projects. We've also got something called the National Institute for Healthcare and Clinical Excellence, or NICE, that we call it, which will evaluate all new technologies. But I think where there's a bit of controversy that wouldn't touch your jobbing clinician very much, but is very live, is the government for ages have pushed for the private sector to have access to NHS data, because you've got this system that treats, you know, hundreds of millions of people a year, employs 1.4 million staff. And there's been a pushback about confidentiality of data and whether it will be misused. And there's a US company called Palantir that have been awarded a big contract for data handling. So that's still quite contentious at the moment about what's your data being used for. And then the other thing is, when it comes to evaluation of things like digital healthcare, telehealth, telecare, electronic patient records, there's one community of people which I'm in who are saying this has not been rigorously evaluated, and actually you're using the NHS as a market and forcing technologies on us because you can profit from them rather because they've been properly evaluated. But I mean, anyway, the idea is that all local NHS organizations have their own research team who can help with recruitment to clinical trials. I don't know if that answers your question.
I
don't think most jobbing clinical staff I work with are involved unless they've got specific academic roles.
Well, it's the same problem, not problem, but it's the same fact everywhere. I call them the two sides of healthcare. There's the delivery of services, which is job one.
Yeah.
But then there's the innovation cycle, which is for tomorrow's, which is job two. Anyway, I think that this has been really excellent and very, I mean, I really like your approach. On the one hand, British people are very proud of the NHS and its record. On the other hand, it has gone through a period of we'll call it disinvestment, and therefore that creates challenges. But it also, to some extent, says what the solution is. It's just keep focused, reinvest, don't get distracted by shiny major reforms, and keep the trust of the physicians, the other staff, and of the population.
Yeah. I mean, the final thing I'd say, really, and I think this is a truism in the health policy community around the world, everyone gets that we need to focus on upstream prevention, keeping people well, keeping people out of hospital, supporting them closer to home, and having care that's more joined up. We need a greater focus on generalism and less super specialization, and unglamorous things like end-of-life care or dementia or frailty are really important. But I think at the moment, those are all aspirations, but we haven't quite got the, you know, the policy levers to make that a reality. And we still have the issue that the values and priorities of doctors often still tend to favor the kind of high tech curative hospital based stuff. So we need to shift that, really, and invest much more in upstream public health prevention, care coordination.
Okay. Well, excellent. Why don't we leave it at that? And
okay.
Thank you for your time. And love to talk in some other time in the future.